Chapter 6 Intimations of the Star Maker. It must not be supposed that the normal fate of intelligent races in the galaxy is to triumph. So far I have spoken mainly of those fortunate echinoderm and nautiloid worlds, which did at last pass triumphantly into the more awakened state, and I have scarcely even mentioned the hundreds, the thousands of worlds which met disaster. This selection was inevitable, because my space is limited. And because these two worlds, together with the even stranger spheres that I shall describe in the next chapter, were to have great influence on the fortunes of the whole galaxy. But many other worlds of human rank were quite as rich in history as those which I have noticed. Individual lives in them were no less varied than lives elsewhere, and no less crowded with distress and joy. Some triumphed. Some in their last phase suffered a downfall, swift or slow, which lent them the splendor of tragedy. But since these worlds play no special part in the main story of the galaxy, they must be passed over in silence, along with the still greater host of worlds which never attained even to human rank. If I were to dwell upon their fortunes, I should commit the same error as a historian who should try to describe every private life and neglect the pattern of the whole community. I have already said that as our experience of the destruction of worlds increased, we were increasingly dismayed by the wastefulness and seeming aimlessness of the universe. So many worlds, after so much distress, attained so nearly to social peace and joy, only to have the cup snatched from them forever. Often disaster was brought by some trivial flaw of temperament or biological nature. Some races had not the intelligence, some lacked the social will, to cope with the problems of a unified world community. Some were destroyed by an upstart bacterium before their medical science was mature. Others succumbed to climatic change, many to loss of atmosphere. Sometimes the end came through collision with dense clouds of dust or gas, or with swarms of giant meteors. Not a few worlds were destroyed by the downfall of a satellite. The lesser body, ploughing its way, age after age, through the extremely rarefied but omnipresent cloud of free atoms in interstellar space, would lose momentum. Its orbit would contract, at first slowly, then rapidly. It would set up prodigious tides in the oceans of the larger body, and drown much of its civilization. Later, through the increasing stress of the planet's attraction, the great moon would begin to disintegrate. First it would cast its ocean in a deluge on men's heads, then its mountains, and then the titanic and fiery fragments of its core. If in none of these manners came the end of the world, then inevitably, though perhaps not till the latter days of the galaxy, it must come in another way. The planet's own orbit, fatally contracting, must bring every world at last so close to its sun that conditions must pass beyond the limit of life's adaptability, and age by age all living things must be parched to death and roasted. Dismay, terror, horror, many a time, seized us as we witnessed these huge disasters. An agony of pity for the last survivors of these worlds was part of our schooling. The most developed of the slaughtered worlds did not need our pity, since their inhabitants seemed capable of meeting the end of all that they cherished with peace, even a strange, unshakable joy, which we in this early stage of our adventure could by no means comprehend. But only a few, very few, could reach this state, and only a few out of the great host of worlds could win through even to the social peace and fullness towards which all were groping. In the more lowly worlds, moreover, few were the individuals who won any satisfaction of life even within the narrow bounds of their own imperfect nature. No doubt one or two here and there, in almost every world, found not merely happiness, but the joy that passes all understanding. But to us, crushed now by the suffering and futility of a thousand races, it seemed that this joy itself, this ecstasy, whether it was supported by scattered individuals or by whole worlds, must after all be condemned as false, and that those who had found it must after all have been drugged by their own private and untypical well-being of spirit, for surely it had made them insensitive to the horror around them. The sustaining motive of our pilgrimage had been the hunger which formerly drove men on earth in search of God. Yes, we had one and all left our native planets in order to discover whether, regarding the cosmos as a whole, the spirit which we all in our hearts obscurely knew and haltingly prized, the spirit which on earth we sometimes call humane, was Lord of the universe, or outlaw, almighty, or crucified. And now it was becoming clear to us that if the cosmos had any Lord at all, he was not that spirit but some other, whose purpose in creating the endless fountain of worlds was not fatherly towards the beings that he had made, but alien, inhuman, dark. Yet while we felt dismay, we felt also increasingly the hunger to see and to face fearlessly whatever spirit was indeed the spirit of this cosmos. For as we pursued our pilgrimage, passing again and again from tragedy to farce, from farce to glory, from glory often to a final tragedy, we felt increasingly the sense that some terrible, some holy, yet at the same time unimaginably outrageous and lethal secret lay just beyond our reach. Again and again we were torn between horror and fascination, between moral rage against the universe or the Star Maker, and unreasonable worship. This same conflict was to be observed in all those worlds that were of our own mental stature. Observing these worlds in the phases of their past growth, and groping as best we might towards the next plane of spiritual development, we came at last to see plainly the first stages of any world's pilgrimage. Even in the most primitive ages of every normal intelligent world, there existed in some minds the impulse to seek and to praise some universal thing. At first this impulse was confused with the craving for protection by some mighty power. Inevitably, the beings theorized that the admired thing must be power, and that worship was mere propitiation. Thus they came to conceive the almighty tyrant of the universe, with themselves as his favored children. But in time it became clear to their prophets that mere power was not what the praiseful heart adored. Then theory enthroned wisdom, or law, or righteousness. And after an age of obedience to some phantom lawgiver, or to divine legality itself, the beings found that these concepts, too, were inadequate to describe the indescribable glory that the heart confronted in all things, and mutely prized in all things. But now, in every world that we visited, alternative ways opened out before the worshippers. Some hoped to come face to face with their shrouded God, solely by inward-searching meditation, by purging themselves of all lesser, all trivial desires, by striving to see everything dispassionately and with universal sympathy. They hoped to identify themselves with the spirit of the cosmos. Often they travelled far along the way of self-perfecting and awakening. But because of this inward absorption, most of them became insensitive to the suffering of their less awakened fellows, and careless of the communal enterprise of their kind. In not a few worlds, this way of the spirit was thronged by all the most vital minds. And because the best attention of the race was given wholly to the inner life, material and social advancement was checked. The sciences of physical nature and of life never developed. Mechanical power remained unknown, and medical and biological power also. Consequently, these worlds stagnated, and sooner or later succumbed to accidents which might well have been prevented. There was a second way of devotion, open to creatures of a more practical temperament. These, in all the worlds, gave delighted attention to the universe around them, and chiefly they found the worshipped thing in the persons of their fellow beings, and in the communal bond of mutual insight and love between persons. In themselves and in each other, they prized above all things love. And their prophets told them that the thing which they had always adored, the universal spirit, the creator, the almighty, the all-wise, was also the all-loving. Let them therefore worship in practical love of one another, and in service of the Love God. And so for an age, short or long, they strove feebly to love and to become members one of another. They spun theories in defence of the theory of the Love God. They set up priesthoods and temples in service of love. And because they hungered for immortality, they were told that to love was the way to attain eternal life. And so love, which seeks no reward, was misconceived. In most worlds, these practical minds dominated over the meditators. Sooner or later, practical curiosity and economic need produced the material sciences. Probing every region with these sciences, the beings found nowhere, neither in the atom, nor in the galaxy, nor for that matter in the heart of man either, any signature of the Love God. And what with the fever of mechanization, and the exploitation of slaves by masters, and the passions of intertribal warfare, and the increasing neglect or coarsening of all the more awakened activities of the spirit, the little flame of praise in their hearts sank lower than it had ever been in any earlier age, so low that they could no longer recognize it. And the flame of love, long fanned by the forced draught of doctrine, but now suffocated by the general obtuseness of the beings to one another, was reduced to an occasional smouldering warmth, which was most often mistaken for mere lust. With bitter laughter and rage, the tortured beings now dethroned the image of the Love God in their hearts. And so without love and without worship, the unhappy beings faced the increasingly formidable problems of their mechanized and hate-racked world. This was the crisis which we in our own worlds knew so well. Many a world up and down the galaxy never surmounted it, but in a few, some miracle which we could not yet clearly envisage raised the average minds of these worlds to a higher plane of mentality. Of this I shall speak later. Meanwhile, I will say only that in the few worlds where this happened, we noticed invariably, before the minds of that world passed beyond our reach, a new feeling about the universe, a feeling which it was very difficult for us to share. Not till we had learned to conjure in ourselves something of this feeling could we follow the fortunes of these worlds. But as we gathered on our pilgrimage, our own desires began to change. We came to wonder whether, in demanding lordship of the universe, for the divinely humane spirit that we prized most in ourselves and in our fellow mortals in all the worlds, we were perhaps impious. We came less and less to require that love should be enthroned behind the stars. More and more we desired merely to pass on, opening our hearts to accept fearlessly whatever of the truth might fall within our comprehension. There was a moment, late in this early phase of our pilgrimage, when, thinking and feeling in unison, we said to one another, "If the Star Maker is love, we know that this must be right. But if he is not, if he is some other, some inhuman spirit, this must be right. And if he is nothing, if the stars and all else are not his creatures but self-subsistent, and if the adored spirit is but an exquisite creature of our minds, then this must be right, this and no other possibility. For we cannot know whether the highest place for love is on the throne or on the cross. We cannot know what spirit rules, for on the throne sits darkness. We know, we have seen, that in the waste of stars love is indeed crucified, and rightly, for its own proving and for the throne's glory. Love and all that is humane we cherish in our hearts. Yet also we salute the throne and the darkness upon the throne. Whether it be love or not love, our hearts praise it, outsoaring reason." But before our hearts could be properly attuned to this new, strange feeling, we had still far to go in the understanding of worlds of human rank, though diverse. I must now try to give some idea of several kinds of worlds very different from our own, but not in essentials more mature.